Welcome to Colors of the Dark. I'm your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, and with me, he has a film coming out in just a couple of weeks. The trailer dropped today, Elric Kane.
Wow, that's more self-promotion than I'm capable of.
I know, I know. You'll
You're
never
much
do
better
it.
at that.
If it was up to Elric, no one who actually listens to the show would ever know he has a movie coming
I even
out.
love the
So
trailer, but almost posted when I post the trailer, almost wanted to write, but don't watch it. Because I want you to be watching the movie. But I actually genuinely think Shudder did an amazing job with trailer, made it super fun. Made me want to rewatch it, and I've seen it 100 times. So
more than that,
yeah, probably.
I would easily
But
think more than that by the time you cut a
but no,
film.
it was
Yeah.
a fun trailer. They did a good job, like with little misdirects and stuff. So I'm excited.
Yeah.
So good for them, because that's gonna be scary as filmmakers. You know, you don't want somebody to misrepresent your thing too dramatic in a way where you don't think it can recover. You know, which happens all the time with trailers.
Oh yeah.
So
oh yeah.
So that was a good one. So I was happy about that.
So we are deep in January. So January in the industry is kind of infamous for not having a lot of good releases. And so it's just kind of like got this weird vibe always of like, you know, that's where, you know, you're not going to get the best horror films in January. But I watched a couple of things this week, including the one that we're going to talk about with our guest companion that I was like pleasantly
Yeah,
surprised, like, you
Companion's a
know.
really good, really solid movie, and really fun and surprising. And so we'll talk about that in the second half, because we both watched that a few days early and got a great talk coming up for that. But yes, it does have that reputation. And so I was looking at this January, February this year going, wow, honestly, all the things I most want to see this year, again, a lot of the stuff that I want to see probably hasn't been announced or we even know about, but a lot of them were in this period. So I was like, oh, this is a good sign. And starting with Wolfman, I was very excited. Lee is 2 for 2 prior to this, like with his two directorial films, both, you know, somewhat contained versions of bigger stories that, you know, he really kind of hit out of the park. And with Wolfman, me and you went to see it on Friday.
We went Friday night.
And I would say this is a swing and a miss, unfortunately.
Yeah, this one is a little harder for me. You know, there was so much at the beginning of this that I loved. And we are actually about to talk about single location horror films, which is what this essentially is. Like we start in a city and within a couple of minutes, it's okay, we're going to go to this house in the country. And then we're driving there and then we're there. And so it does function as a single location horror film. There was a lot about the setup and moving into this that I loved, but there was something else going on and I haven't put my finger on it yet. I know that there were definitely a couple of times where Elric and I would lean over during the film and go, did that scene, was that editing weird? That editing felt weird.
Or just, it just story. Look, again, now the first thing when the movie ended, I literally turned to you and I said, this is what I imagine the pitch meeting being, which is Lee goes into an office and says, I want to remake The Fly. And somebody goes, but we have Wolfman, but I want to make The Fly. We have Wolfman. All right, I'll make Wolfman The Fly. Because it was,
that was
so
it.
overt.
It was very The Fly. It was,
you know,
very The
to the
Fly.
Point where, like, I get it. You want to discover the humanity, but The Fly has such a progression of a loss of humanity. It's like, that's why it's a masterpiece. Like, just watching the guy slowly become, say, in this, it isn't that. And look, I think some things, we talked about it a bit. Again, some of this is insider baseball. Like, sometimes a movie just doesn't quite work. I'm sure it works for some people. There's some really interesting things about The Swing. I think it looks good. I think there's a really interesting angle on the body horror. But sometimes the things just don't kind of come together. And one thing I thought is, like, you know, if you're making a film for a bigger studio, even though it's low budget on a big studio level, maybe, it still feels like you're making something that this feels like a Glass Eye, like it would have been a better in a Glass Eye Picks production model. Like, this could have been half of $500,000 and you could pull off everything except for the truck scene. And it would make sense that you're making this contained, smaller, more emotion-driven movie. But when you have all those tools and you're watching something that could go bigger, it does feel like it's limiting its own self to me. And I think Julia Garner is an excellent actress. In fact, I've liked her in almost every film and TV show she's been in. But, like, I really felt strongly that she was wildly miscast in this movie, and the reason I couldn't feel anything, because I didn't believe that she is a mother. I didn't believe that they were a couple. Christopher Abbott's solid in this role, makes sense, but and that's a tough thing about casting, because probably, as we know in the world, you don't even get to meet actors together.
You can't
and
chemistry
yeah,
read people
it's
anymore.
Changed.
That's
It's all,
not how it works.
No, and it's really
maybe if
hard.
You're Lucas
Yeah.
or, you know, Marvel level, you could get chemistry reads,
yeah.
But No, she and I will agree with you on that. Like, she felt like the babysitter who was kind of tagging
And that's
along
an
for
age,
most.
partly an age thing, because she is,
And
look,
it's an
she's
age
25,
thing. Yeah, she looks
23 or
so
something.
young. And so buying her as the mom of like an 8-year-old kid, it was hard.
But he also goes, and again, this we will try not to spoil too much, but he goes for such an inarticulate creature, which is interesting, right? Like as the character's changing. But once he can't articulate, it's like hard to, like, even though you know he's trying to hold back or whatever, it becomes very difficult to care. And that's the thing about Brundlefly, right? And Fly is only truly inarticulate when he's the massive fly at the very end of the movie.
I will say what I absolutely loved about Wolfman was it had some really good practical effects in it, like the gore, how the transformations were happening. Like, that stuff kept me alert and giddy the entire time because it was suddenly like, oh, we're going to watch his jaw grow and his teeth fall out and things like that. So, definitely some kudos on some really good effects work there.
Yeah, some gruesome stuff. Yeah, look, again, sometimes I think it's a good and unlike a bad movie where the idea's dumb and the intention's dumb and the movie's dumb. This is not like that. This is more like it
No.
doesn't quite work, but the intention is interesting. But I wonder if it was the wrong intention for this particular property. And that's, it's its own interesting thing. Again, it doesn't all not work. There's some really cool stuff in it. But yeah, for me, this one just doesn't, it's just not quite on the same level as the previous two films we've made. But that's Wolfman, our first big release of the year, really.
Yes. Yeah. So I went from Wolfman to the next night. I decided to watch a very, well, not small movie. I will say it feels massive and it feels quite cold, but it is definitely small in the shape of like Wolfman. And that is The Damned. Have you seen this one
No,
yet?
I think it was, you must have a screener because I think it's still in the
I
theaters.
did. Yeah, so I had seen this one playing while we were at Wolfman. I remember this had been like popping up as I was buying tickets, and I was like, okay, I'll proceed. And it's directed by Thor Dvor Paulsen. I'm not even sure where that is out of, but it's basically it is about a ship that sinks off the coast. So I will say 19th century. So we're doing period piece here, and it is about a ship that sinks off the coast of an Icelandic fishing village. So I think that the bulk of the film is Icelandic. I know that there was some Ireland has some stuff going on in there as well, because there was a couple of Irish cast members. But yeah, it was so we're basically it opens and we're in this very cold, very rural, old-timey like 18th century or 19th century fishing village. And it is all men and then two women who actually run, kind of the fish house. And it opens with them talking about how they are starving, that usually they're, they've got these racks outside and they're like, usually this is completely full with fish by this time of the winter, that, usually the fishing's really good. But this winter has been awful, so much so that they are being forced to eat their bait. And so there's no fishing, they're just eating the bait. One day they're back out, they're going to go back out and try again. And it's a really cool shot where you suddenly see one person's face turns and looks, and then everybody kind of follows suit. And then off in the distance, and it takes you a sec to see what you're looking at, you see this massive ship, and it just kind of like keels forward and then starts going down. Like, you literally watch the ship start to sink from a distance. And it's real fucking eerie because you can't hear it. So they're just all standing there in silence watching it. And it is really, really creepy. And then things start washing up on the shore. So they decide, they're like, we can't help them. It's too dangerous to go out there and help them. It's we just have to accept that they're have perished. And all of a sudden things start washing up on shore. Like, the very first day they find a barrel of salted meat that has washed up, and it becomes a question of, well, we're starving, do we eat this fated ship's barrel of salted meat? And then things start happening to make them think that people might still be alive out there, surviving on rocky outcrops and things like that. But through turn of events, you get that this village has done some pretty messed up things, and they are now damned. And they, the woman who kind of runs the village, who runs the fishing business at least, comes to believe that there is this monster that is now, I'll call it like a demon that is now controlling the island, that is haunting people and driving them to madness or driving them to do awful things. Real small. So real small. We're talking like 12 people on a really cold island living in shacks with candlelight. But there was something really good about this. Honestly, had I known all of the plot going in, I probably would have been like, may not be for me. This sounds super slow burn, but I watched it without knowing a lot of that and absolutely loved it. I thought this was a really cool horror film. It is definitely slow burn, so keep that in mind. But yeah, this is The Damned, an Icelandic horror film set in the 19th century, but I absolutely enjoyed it. I think this one is hitting VOD very soon.
Yeah, you had me at salted meat, so you didn't have to try hard on that.
Assaulted
The
meat.
salted meat.
That of salted
That of
meat.
salted meat. Okay, well, a nicely fast-paced one for you is a for those of you going through withdrawals, not getting the Strangers Pray at Night part two quick enough because you're sitting around going, "Oh, part one hooked me so much. Can't wait for part two and part three." Sweet love of God. Anyway,
Isn't it three and four? It'd be three and
I
four.
have no idea. I don't know if I watched the other ones. But anyway, this movie I thought was better than the Strangers remake. And this is called, but very similar in some ways, called Last Straw. It is on Shudder. It is a small, basically a very kind of like a young waitress who's kind of obviously in a dead-end job, but her dad owns this diner. So she's been promoted as manager, even though she's probably younger than a lot of her coworkers and they're all a little pissy about it. Now, I am ready for the Jeremy Sisto playing dad's period of cinema now, because I was very excited to see Jeremy Sisto, who, for most of us, we think Hideaway, Serial Killer and Hideaway and May and all these great movies. He's in
6 feet
Wrong Turn.
under.
Yeah, I loved her. I've always loved her. I think he's a really good actor. But now seeing him play the dad, and he's still cool. He's still cool dad. So I'm happy for this period. Anyway, his daughter's working there, basically on this day, running this middle of nowhere diner. There's some young punks outside playing with like carcasses of some animals and being punks and kind of upsetting her. So she kind of is really ballsy and just to their faces, you have to leave, otherwise I'm going to call the cops, and basically gets a little in their face. And later in the piece, she's going to be alone in the night shift. She's going to be all alone at this diner. Not the best parenting move I've seen on screen this year, where the dad's ordering her to do that. But so she's going to run this diner by herself, and no one's going to be there. And then suddenly, people wearing masks, very a la Strangers, these young guys that she told to leave earlier, show up wearing these masks, and things get menacing and violent ensues. And it's definitely got that in a Wrong Turn, and not Wrong Turn. What's our film, your next kind of type mashup. Now, the reason to watch this movie, it's a low budget movie. I think it's pretty well made actually and looks good, but the actress who plays this role is like, this is what hooked me. Our friend told me to Dick said you should watch this, but Jessica Belkin is the actress, and I'm not that interested in, like, 22-year-old blonde pretty active, like, that just is not a type that would usually even register for me to like want to cast. And so when I start watching this, she does all the things that make you more interested, because she feels more alive, she feels a little bit more nuanced, she feels like she has a whole backstory going through her head every second you're watching. So major new to me, new actress alert. Like, I mean, she's been around for a while probably, but like, I hadn't seen her in anything, so I wrote down the name. Definitely worth watching for that. The it has a big twist at the midway that just kind of shifts how you're seeing the events of the movie. And that will, that was his favorite thing about it. For me, worked a little less, but I still thought this was really cool. Fun watch, late night watch. And definitely for the, if you're looking for that stranger's itch, while we wait. So that's Last Straw.
Yeah, I haven't seen her. She says here she was like a vampire girl in American Horror Story. Yeah, I
She's been on
haven't seen
TV and
her.
stuff. Again, sometimes it's just like, it takes somebody being the lead in something for you to realize how, but I was like really taken with, like, okay, she's really good. And because sometimes those can be hard ages to cast well, because there's a lot of TV actors, who are doing a lot of TV who maybe are less interesting when they're put on a big screen to me. But no, she's really good. Jessica Belkin.
Jessica
Listen
Belkin.
up, casting
Okay.
directors.
Because they're all listening to
Yeah,
our
I'm sure
show.
at
They're
least a couple
all
are.
there. So this next film I'm going to talk about is one that I also, much like The Damned, went in knowing very little about. I had not seen trailers or anything. I just got the screening link and a couple of stills, and the stills made it look super gory and visceral. So I was in. And then I remembered that you had actually seen it at a prior festival. And that is Grafted. Now, Grafted, directed by Sasha Rainbow, is set to go to Shudder in just a couple of weeks. Actually, I think like by the time this show airs, it's going to be on Shudder. And it is about it's got an amazing cold open. So it is about a young Chinese girl who is working with her father, and her father's kind of this premier Chinese scientist researching skin grafting techniques. And both he and his daughter have scars on their faces, have these kind of like big facial there's not a lot of detail of how they got them, but she has a large blotch on her cheek and he has something on his nose. And he is trying to research how they can cover this up. And he's looking at these skin grafting techniques. And what he's trying to create is like some type of synthesized skin that you can just lay over top of the person's regular skin and it will fuse and it will just completely cover up the blemish. And so our cold open, she's doing research with him. She's working right beside him, even though that she's really young. And there's an accident in the lab. It is a fucking baller cold open. This cold open was amazing. There's a horrible accident in the lab and he dies and she is kind of left there with his research. We now fast forward a while and she is now a young adult and she has received this scholarship to go study at a school in New Zealand. And so she heads, leaves China and goes over to New Zealand to stay with her aunt and her cousin. And she takes with her all of her father's research on skin grafting. Now she still has a horrible scar type thing, splotch on her cheek that she is trying to cover up. And she's very self-conscious of it. Like she always is dressing somewhat awkwardly to try to cover it up with scarves and hats and holding her hair over her cheek and things like that. So she's real uncomfortable. So when she gets to New Zealand, her cousin is very outwardly spoken, dresses really hip, doesn't even speak Chinese anymore, whereas she is feeling very reserved, very self-conscious, and really having a hard time fitting in. But she finds a professor who is kind of desperate for some type of cutting-edge research and starts working with her, really kind of bringing her father's skin grafting techniques back out. And she ends up developing this incredible skin grafting technique. But it gets really fucked up because you have to have skin to do it. And so, yeah, this movie, it gets hyper gory, hyper gory. I will say there were parts of it that felt like two different movies was kind of one of my biggest hangups because there are these really hyper, really dark, intense kind of torture porny scenes immediately followed with these really bright kind of Mean Girls-esque scenes. And so it really felt like there was this duality that did not always mesh together. That said, there were some really good gore scenes in this movie and it still had some kind of like what the fuck scenes. Like there was one scene in particular that was like a jaw drop scene that I really enjoyed. But this one's coming to Shudder in just a couple of weeks. Definitely for anybody in for some like gory surprises, Grafted is decent.
Yeah, it's definitely a horror comedy with a lot of gore. I did appreciate some of the gore scenes quite a lot, but I just, you know me, and to certain tones for me, I'm always like, I just can't. I also appreciated that it was a mad science movie, and we don't get many of those anymore, I
Oh,
feel.
yeah.
A little more rare, but yeah, the Kiwis are going strong in this movie. There's definitely a lot of good Kiwi accents in here.
So yeah, is this is Kiwi made, yes?
This is, yes, she, I looked her up because she wasn't somebody I was familiar with. And it looks like she was somebody
I'm
who
not.
was a Kiwi who like studied in England for a long time and then came back or something. So yeah, it's just, I would like to know more about Sasha Rainbow. But I believe she has her roots in New Zealand. And that's why she made it
Okay.
there. But weirdly enough, I was expecting her, like when you look up the, this is a movie that definitely feels like I was definitely expecting, oh, this is probably a Chinese immigrant filmmaker to New Zealand telling that story. And it wasn't. It looks like a European person from who lived in Europe for a period. So I was like, oh, that's an interesting choice. So again, I have no issues with that. I just thought that was surprising because it felt very authentic in its
Chinese,
Setup.
it
It felt
does.
like that was very important to the story they were telling. So I would like to know more about it.
Yeah, and so much of it is in Chinese. Like
Yeah,
she
that's fair.
communicates with her aunt in Chinese and her dad in Chinese. And like when she's talking to herself, it's always in Chinese. So yeah, it feels like legit. I will say, I just realized this is her first feature. So I will give her kudos to that because parts of this felt incredibly, there was vision. Like
Yeah.
that was the, you know, it felt competent. It felt like there was a strong vision, you know, behind it, even if it did have kind of these weird tonal shifts. She's done a couple short films and a music video, so this is like her first
It
feature.
has
So
money behind it, you can
yeah.
tell. It's not like an, it
Yeah.
doesn't feel like a small indie, it feels quite big.
No, the effects definitely are pricey. Like they feel real and they feel big.
Yeah, so I saw one that I feel like you will probably like, kind of. It's called, I hadn't heard of it, so I was just looking for a couple of more things to watch, called The Calendar Killer, brand new movie on Amazon. It's German, but when I watched it, it's a brand new one, but I watched it with the English dub and it was fine. There's like sometimes, usually I'll go to the original language, but this was totally done at, on a good level. And this is kind of like a hyped up, has like somewhere between a hyped up Lifetime movie and like Snowman, those movies we watch. So basically, a guy.
Oh, those like fun
Yeah, it's like
thrillers.
those fun. That's why I watch it, because I was like, okay, Calendar Killer, what's this? And it's brand new. And so it is a guy. At the start, you find out that there is somebody out there called the Calendar Killer. What he does is he draws this little symbol on the properties. He comes in, warns a couple, a woman, it's always the wife, and says, either, I don't know when he waits till the calendar's up. So, like, I don't know, I can't remember if it was a week or a month, and says, either you're going to die or your husband's going to die. Or, but I'm get, if you don't kill your husband, I am going to come and kill you. I'm giving you this opportunity to kill your husband to save yourself. And so he does this to all these people, and it's implied that this has been going on for a while. We don't know who he is. And then it cuts to this guy who's a phone, he's the basically phone support, like some countries, America might have this, but where like if a woman's worried walking home at night, you can call someone and they'll stay on the line with you until you get in the on the bus to make sure you're safe. Kind of like, I know there's angels that walk people home, but this is that. So this guy's a service, he's on the hotline, he helps a couple people out of bad situations, and then this woman calls him and she's like, I was marked by the calendar killer, but my husband doesn't believe me, and tonight's the night. And then so we start seeing her crazy night unfold and all the things she's going through as she's deciding, like, am I going to kill myself? Or am I going to kill my husband? Her husband's a real piece of shit. He's like kind of abusive. And then this guy's trying to help her through the events of the night as other twists and turns are kind of coming as the movie's unfolding. And so it has all those things that you like about a movie, and some of them it does a little on the nose and a little bit cheesy in that Lifetime way, but then a couple of them, there's a couple of moments where I was expecting it to be very safe, and suddenly there's a kind of an Eyes Wide Shutty party scene that went quite surprisingly S&M and sexual, where I was like, oh, I wasn't expecting that from this very mainstream looking piece. So it was kind of a fun thrill. Again, I wouldn't say it's some very deep movie, but it was, for something I hadn't even heard of, it just popped up on Amazon this week. I thought it was kind of entertaining. I definitely thought of you watching it. I was like, I could see you liking this one and enjoying
I
seeing it.
just wrote it down.
Yeah.
This sounds so much like something I'm going to
Yeah.
enjoy
Again, it's
because I
late at
love,
night, you know?
yeah, those heavy twists, like serial killer
Yes.
thrillers, where the serial killer has some type of complicated MO.
Yeah.
I am so
Yes, this
in.
does. This has a lot of, and it reminded me, because me and you just went to Wolfman this week, and one of the trailers was for the movie, and I started wondering, is this a remake? Was for the movie by the Happy Death Day director, where a woman goes on a date with a man and then gets a text saying, we have your family, we're going to kill them unless you kill your date. And so it was similar kind of concept, and I wondered if it was somewhat taken from that, but I probably not. It's just an interesting hook. Yeah, Calendar Killer on Amazon, free on Amazon if you're a Prime member. So,
I am excited to see that
yeah, I think
movie,
you'll
that
like it.
Christopher Landon film
Yes,
as
yeah, no,
well.
that
It
looked
looked
good.
really
It
cool.
looked big, it
Yeah.
looked fun.
No, and even like we were spoken about it on Deep Cuts, but like how much we enjoyed Carry On over the
Yeah.
holidays. Like that was just such a, I don't have to think, you know, level of popcorn tension for
Yeah, it would
me.
have been a
You know,
VHS we would have rented back in the day and had fun, you know?
I would have written that in the early
Yeah.
2000s and had fun with it. And then even on Deep Cuts, we were talking about oh gosh, the one it's Kurt Russell. Why can't I
Breakdown, yeah.
remember? Breakdown was just so good,
Yeah,
was
so
a
good.
thriller that I had just seen a couple of weeks ago for the first time and was just so good.
Yeah.
Very you know, it's got references to other films. Like it feels definitely like a remake of a French film. But that said, it's really cool and does its own thing. So
Yeah.
yeah. Okay, so I'm gonna move us. I've got comics left because I did read
I
a
only
comic.
have one more movie.
Do
Okay, real
it.
quick. This is another one I actually think is more you than me, but I enjoyed it. This was another one our friend Dick had seen. Hashtag Missing Couple. Have you heard of this? It's brand new
I have
found
not.
footage movie. It is on Tubi now. It wasn't on Tubi last week. It was still a new release and like a rentable. And it's interesting. So it's like basically like you're watching a couple who have been putting all of their world online. They are called Real Van Life hashtags.
Oh God, van life. It's a
Yeah.
whole.
Yeah. So they live
So
in a
this is
van. You live in a van.
insider
Yeah.
baseball. No. RV people think van people are nuts, and van people think that RV people are all rednecks. And then people who drive C classes like me think that people who drive A classes are all hoity. And so
Interesting.
yeah, there's all these like interesting divisions. And then there are people who only drive retro trailers. Like there's a whole subdivisions. Van life people are all like bohemian wanderlust. Yeah,
Yeah,
so
that's
it's
what it is. I mean, they don't get into that nuance, but it's fun. So you're seeing the YouTube videos of how they've created a following. They're pretty popular. It's a husband wife team. Interestingly enough, the actors on screen are also it's Austin and Jana Jenkins. So that's kind of fun. You're watching a real couple. They've renovated their van. This is what they do. But basically, then it goes like we're decided to change up this year. We put down some money and we bought this little property in Mississippi. We had a lot of land. One of our viewers, gave us a good tip on this thing, and we thought we're gonna. It's just a shack, but we're gonna redo it and live there. And we're excited. So this will be our new season, basically. So you're watching all this, and it's all through videos and stuff. So it's the kind of stuff that when you watch those movies where it's built on screens and whatnot. And then there's kind of like a hard cut at a certain point as you're watching this, and there's this guy with a beard, and he's like in his car recording himself. He's like, all right, so they disappeared, a while back, and I'm been following their channel forever, and I'm gonna travel out there and I'm gonna try to figure this out. So now we're watching one, he's not an influencer, they were influencers, he's like somebody who liked their show, he's gonna travel there. And so at the same time you're seeing his story on that same farm location, we're then watching all the various tapes leading up to where things start getting precarious to where they became hashtag missing couple. And it's like there's some really interesting stuff. Like, A, it's just like if you're into, again, it's kind of movie. If I turn this a found footage type thing on late at night, the people better be believable. Otherwise, I'm not going to last. And if they're even vaguely familiar, then it's very easy to just sit down and keep watching a movie like this. And I found it quite fun. There's some really good little moments like where what's happening could be more almost into the supernatural vein, and you're not quite sure. It never gives away everything, but even by the end, but it has some pretty great twists between the two storylines that eventuate. And the main couple are kind of getting on each other's nerves at a certain point as somebody is menacing them on this farm, leaving weird packages, weird symbols for them. So, classic found footage buildup. But it was surprisingly decent and had a couple things that pulled it together, I thought, at the end. And so if this, from listening to this, certain people just balk at this type of movie and others flock to it. I feel like this is definitely in your wheelhouse that you would at least find it interesting because you like, the mixed reality found footage type stories.
I definitely do. And my favorite thing about this so far is when I look on IMDb, the first couple of reviews say, "Is this real?"
Yes, I think they
And
went
that
hard for that.
makes
Yeah.
me so giddy. If you're blurring that line, of course it's not fucking real,
Yeah.
but as soon as you're blurring that line, I'm like, "Oh, I'm
Well,
so in
they
on
went
this."
so hard that when I wrote down, it's two directors, Jacques Edelin and Oliver Malden. But they went so hard that if you go on IMDb, the credits only have the two actors who are the couple, which is very bizarre, given the other guy is like in half the movie, and I can't even find his name. So that tells you like they're going so far to the like it's a real thing. Like I was very surprised by that. I was like, wow, I can't even find this actor's name because they're just positioning this as two. It's not really a twist because like he's in it pretty early. So it's just it's cool. But I do like when people go all out, like pulling the cannibal Holocaust of it, trying to hide the reality. But I think you'll find this one interesting. And again, it just popped up on Tubi. So missing couple, but it's a hashtag at the start.
I do enjoy found footage. It's one of those things where I'm always like, I want to try a found footage. I would probably do it as like a short film first. But it's just one of those, like, I feel like It's a completely different type of filmmaking, and I really want to try it out just to keep trying
I
things.
read
So,
one
yeah.
story. I've never thought I would want to make found footage, but I read one, even though I do like them. I read one. I'm a very aesthetic person. I just like aesthetic, but I read one story by this writer, Michael Wehunt, and I'm a big fan of it. He's only so far written short story collections, but he's writing his first full novels coming out soon, and I'm a big fan of his writing. And in this book called Greener Pastures, he has this short film called Halloween Something Haunt. And I wrote to him about it as soon as I read it. It was probably a 30-page book and a story. And I was just like, this is the first time I read a found footage thing where I could completely see it. And it was real. It's scary and goes in a direction that I hadn't seen found footage going before. But the good news is, even though I didn't get to do it because we had a convo about it, but now I see why I didn't, because it turns out that his new novel is going to be a full version of that story. So I am
Oh.
excited to see what he did with it, because the short story is so interesting and graphic and kind of goes even body horror-ish and Blair Witchy. And so anyway, that was the only time though in my whole life where I've read something where I was like, yeah, I would totally make this, even though it's found footage. And I don't say that belittling, it's just a found footage. You have to be willing to give up any kind of a certain kind of control and let, because the ones that are too controlled don't work as well. Found footage actually works the more random it feels. That's why Blair Witch is so good, because you feel like those people made it. You feel like those actors, the humans in the movie are making it themselves, you know?
No, like some of the ones that I consider to be more aesthetic, I think are equally successful. Like as above, so below.
That's
I feel
very
like
aesthetic,
has
but
an
that's a little.
aesthetic to
No,
it.
it definitely has an aesthetic. I don't know if that one works as a believing what I'm watching ever. It's,
Oh,
yeah.
no, I definitely
Yeah,
don't
no,
believe it at any
it's
point.
a
Or
fun
like the
movie,
other
but
one, like I love the aesthetic of Dorothy. Oh shit, the one about the
yes,
Alzheimer's
taking a
and
Deborah
yeah.
Logan. Yeah, that's the no,
Taking,
that's very
thank you,
stripped
Taking of
down. Yeah.
Deborah Logan. Yeah, it's very, and it's structured out almost like a
Yeah.
documentary, but then it goes off the rails at the end and feels a little bit more raw. Like, I love the aesthetical choices
Yeah.
that they gave that one. But yeah, I don't, I mean, I'm not going into those believing it's real in any
Yeah.
capacity.
But even just the suspension of believing, like when we're watching, it feels real. We might know it's a movie, but they do a good job of like, no, I think you'll like this one. I think this is a
Yeah,
good
that.
demographic.
I need you to see. I don't even know if it's come out yet, but I covered it when we were doing Fantastic Fest in the fall. The Inland
Oh no, I
Empire
did see it.
Critter
I saw it
one.
in Knoxville. Yeah, it was really
Oh,
good.
yeah. You watched that in
Strange
Knoxville. Yeah. I
Harvest,
liked, yeah, Strange Harvest.
that
Yeah.
I'd call, even though it is found footage, it's also in that like document faux
It's like
documentary.
mockumentary.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it is really good. I think
I
people will
liked that
dig. That
one.
feels like a real good Shutter film, like that people would just. I don't know if it has a release planned yet, but it's a good one.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm gonna dig in on a couple of quick books because I read a lot during the holiday, didn't get to cover any of them last show. So I just want to give them some quick shout-outs. Hey, y'all, I also have a comic book out called Barstow. First issue came out in December, and we just or sorry, November, we just released our second issue. Third one's coming top of February. Just have to mention that because Elric's really
I want to
bad at
read it. I want to read the
self-promotion.
second one. I haven't read it yet.
I know it sold out really quickly
I know.
around LA, which is awesome, but I have copies if you want
All
one.
right.
Okay, so let me start with some of my favorite graphic novels that I read over the holiday. So this one had been on my shelf for a while. This came out last year, I believe. And this is Houses of the Unholy by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. I fucking loved this. And I don't even know if this started as, I assume it started as Siri, but I read the whole graphic novel and it was just a phenomenal read. It is basically looking at something like Michelle Remembers. So it's looking at the Satanic Panic. It is about a girl. She's all grown up now and she is being confronted by this police officer, FBI agent who kind of says, you need to come with me. And the people are being murdered around you. You have to come with me and help me. And she's like, what the fuck? And she doesn't want anything to do with it. And we quickly find out that she was part of a group of kids who, when they were 6 or 7, got caught up in the Satanic Panic accusation and accused one of, I can't, like daycare workers of being a Satanist and claimed that they were taken down into tunnels and forced to do all this crazy shit. And now looking back at it, they all are like, no, no, we were coerced. We were caught up in this. None of this shit ever happened. But the woman that they accused killed herself back when they were accusing her, even though that she was innocent. And all these kids, now that they have grown up, are being murdered. Hmm. And so, and it's this agent detective shows up and is like, you have to come with me because you hold the secret to who's doing this, because he's picking you all off slowly. And it's unpacking both the story of what happened to these kids during the satanic panic that led them to make these accusations against this woman, as well as the crimes that are taking place in present day. This was amazing. I loved this. I ended up binge reading it in two nights. So that was The Houses of the Unholy. Next one, I'm talking about, this one's also a graphic novel, maybe one of the most beautiful things I have read in a long time. This one came out, I believe, 2 years ago. Yeah, this is 2023. It won an Eisner Award in 2024. And this is called Somna, and it is by Tula Lotte and Becky Clonan. And it is about 1600s England. So this is a period graphic novel, and it's set in this tiny little English village in 1600s. And it's about this woman who is married to basically the witch hunter of the town. And it opens with one of her friends being burned to death because everybody in town has accused her of being a witch. And her husband, who is the head witch hunter, think like full like Vincent Price, like Witchfinder General, is caught up in like, you know, I have to go to the city because we're finding new ways to stomp out witches. And I believe it was this woman and this woman. And so he's barely home. And while he's barely home, this thing starts coming to her at night, trying to have sex with her. And it's like a demon. And it comes and it's seducing her. And it's saying like, you know, I'll do what your husband never does. I want to be with you. And it's all about her giving over to seduction while this is going on, and then trying to hide it from her husband. And at first she thinks it's just nightmares, but then it evolves into something much more. And you realize that it's not just nightmares that she's having. It's these like crazy, wild sexual dreams. This is an incredibly sexual book.
Sounds like my bag.
It's so hot. It is just so hot at the same time. And it's all in the backdrop of like this witch finding, and you're questioning if what is coming to her at night is evil. It has to be if it's having this like great sex with her. This one, I read the entire thing in one day, and it was just an amazing book. So that is Somna.
And when is it set? What period? What's the
1600s? Wow, so, okay, in England. So yeah, she's very repressed, husband or wife to a witch hunter. And yeah, it's cabins, you know, kind of in the middle of a town square, and all the women are scared to death of being accused of being witches.
Yeah, sounds cool.
I'll give a quick shout out to a YA one that I read over the holidays that I loved called It's Watching. Mm-hmm. This one is coming out in February. It's about a couple of middle school kids who sneak out one night and decide to go to this cemetery in town that's famous, this place called Bachelor's Grove Cemetery, where they want to get proof of a ghost actually existing. And they've heard that there are actual ghosts there, that if you stand in this like circle of gravestones, that ghosts will actually appear. Well, they go there and they don't find a ghost. What ends up happening is they get chased off by a security guard who's like, hey, you crazy kids, get out of my graveyard. But then the next day, this app appears on all of their phones with a countdown. And all it keeps saying is, I'm watching you. And so they're trying to figure out, they know that something is going to happen at the end of this countdown, and they're trying to figure out what they do. This is like middle grade novel, but it was like super, super scary for a middle grade novel. So I wanted to mention this one because it's coming out soon. This is that's It's Watching by Lindsay Curry. And then the last one I'm going to mention, because Bria Grant, who was on my show when I did the book episode back in summer, whenever you were out.
It's like the most famous episode ever. I've heard you guys reference it more, but I wasn't even there. So
I know. No, we dropped some really good book titles. So yeah, we have to. This is one that she had told me about on that episode called The Night Guest. And she told me that it was one of her favorite from last year. And this is, I'm going to mispronounce the writer's name. It's set in Reykjavik. And the writer's name is Hildur Nutsdottir. I apologize for whatever I just said. That is so wrong. But the book of this.
Iceland, right?
Iceland. It's an Icelandic horror novel. But it's such an easy read. It is such a great, tense, easy read. about a woman who is having problems sleeping. She's waking up exhausted. She thinks she's sleeping. She doesn't think she's having problems falling asleep, but whatever's happening, she's waking up exhausted. She's waking up with these weird bruises on her body. She doesn't know what's going on. So she goes to her doctor, and her doctor's like, maybe you're not really falling asleep. Maybe you're, having like really fitful dreams or something like that. Buy yourself one of those wristbands so that you can actually like keep track of like when you're in REM. Get a nice one so we can actually track like what your sleeping patterns are, and then let me know how you're sleeping at night, and you'll actually be able to see like whether or not you're getting a good night's sleep. So she buys it, wakes up the next morning exhausted, looks at it, and realizes that she had walked 25,000 steps that night.
Wow.
And then realizes that she has been leaving her apartment and doing something, and starts, and she can follow it on the sleep app. Like she can see, her GPS tracking of where she's going. But from the moment that she falls asleep, she has no recollection of what's going on. So she starts trying to figure out what she is doing at night in these specific locations around town. It is No, this is such just a quick, super psychological horror read, but
Sounds
it's
cool.
good.
As you're
This is
talking, I was
good.
looking at Goodreads, and the author has a couple other books that look interesting too. So I'll have to
Yeah,
check
I
them out.
feel like I need to read other ones by this author. The Night Guest, it was just, I read this thing in 3 days, and it was just like start to finish, and I could not wait to get back in. I ended up listening to the last part of it on audiobook because we were traveling to a relative's house, and I didn't want to stop reading it, and I can't read in the car without getting sick. So I had to buy the audiobook to keep reading, and the audiobook was great too. So The Night Guest. Thanks, Bria Grant. That's a tight one.
Okay, nice. I'll put it on my list.
Okay, so that's like my four reads. So that was just summarizing Houses of the Unholy, Somna, It's Watching, and The Night Guest.
And you can follow us on Goodreads app. As our I did start my new challenge. I reached my challenge last year, so I have my new one. This one I'm just said 20 books for a year. I'm only one book in. I'm off to a slow start, but I'm gonna get there.
Oh, you'll get
Yeah, I'm
there.
reading
Yeah.
a good one right now. So okay,
What are you
one
reading? Hold on. What are you reading, real
Well,
quick,
I'm
before
reading
we
that
jump?
I started the year with Revival, which was a Stephen King one from the recent period that I hadn't heard, and it was actually really good. Very Lovecrafty by the end, in terms of somebody trying to master death and through science and stuff. It was
Wait, Stephen King is doing
that one
Lovecrafty?
was a Lovecrafty vibe for
Oh,
King.
that's
Yeah, it was
cool.
an interesting one.
Yeah.
But the one I'm reading right now is what's this one called? It's part of the Michael Slade ones that I've talked about on here before. With I talked about Ghoul and Headhunter were the first two books in the series of these detective groups who are Canadian Mounties and another detective solving these really elaborate serial killers, very procedurals. I've just forgotten what the new one's called. I think it's Ripper, the third one. It's not
Ooh,
new. There's
nice.
like 10 of these, but so far I don't even know exactly what the crime in this one is, but they're always pretty horrific. Like all of these books have had some of the more brutal described killings that I've read. The second one was very Lovecraftian, so I dug that. Like literally, like the killer is reenacting Lovecraft, which is interesting.
Nice.
Anyway, so I'll let you know when I finish it.
Sweet. Okay. Well, let's get to our guest.
Okay, well, we're excited to welcome on the show the writer director of the new film Companion, Mr. Drew Hancock. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for joining us. So let's start with talking about Companion, and then we can get a little bit deeper into kind of your background and everything. But without too many spoilers, can I ask kind of where the concept of it came from? I mean, you can definitely use kind of what's in the trailer, I'd say.
Yeah, so every project is different, as you know. Like you never know. It could be a scene, it can be a character, it can be just literally just like a shot that pops in your head, and that's what gets the ball rolling for Companion. It's the strangest thing. I've never had this happen before. Like literally, like the log line popped into my head. Like the amount of characters. Like oh, the three couple. Like I have the journal entry the day I came up with the idea, and it's like the log line for the movie. Three couples go to a cabin in the middle of the woods. One of them finds out X, and shit goes kind of haywire. And so, Yeah, nothing. That's not never that happened 4 years ago, like January 1st of 2021. It's not happened since. Like that kind of like present that was given to me. I don't ever anticipate that ever happening again because it was just such an odd moment. But yeah, it just it like yeah, it like fully baked just popped into my head. And of course, as a writer, I'm like, well, it's the first idea. That kind of popped in my head. It can't be the right one. I got to keep generating ideas and ideas and ideas. Cause like, you know, backing up just a little bit, the whole purpose of writing Companion is cause I was in a place in my career where I wasn't getting opportunities that I wanted. Like I love genre. I love thrillers. I love horror. I love like anything with like a ghost, a serial killer, a robot, anything like that. Like that's my jam. But I was working in comedy and like specifically punching up like YA stuff, like not the fun, like post-apocalyptic YA stuff, like the Netflix, like romances. And, you know, just found myself in a position where I was like, well, I need to ha it, like I'm not getting the jobs I want, so I should write something that kind of represents my voice. And so Companion was sprung from like the desire to have something that represented me, and it was the first idea. And so I spent, you know, wasted my time like 4 or 5 more months just generating other ideas, just being like, well, it's the first idea. First idea is never the best idea. And sure enough, I just wasted those 5 months thinking of something else, and eventually like took a producer for lunch and said, hey, here's like 5 ideas. I like them all. And she was like, that first one's great. Like I can see it. Like, yeah. Like I could have been working out, I could have had a draft done by now. But anyway, like that's the inception of the idea and kind of where it came from and the purpose of it too.
I'm going to ask a quick side note question because I have an ongoing text chain with a group of screenwriters arguing. When you are doing your like beginning idea journaling, do you handwrite or do you type that shit out?
That was handwriting. I got really into bullet journaling, like really obsessed by it. Yeah. And I got really, my handwriting is great because I care about that, and I want to like I need it to be legible, and I need it to be like aesthetically pleasing because I'm just an OCD weirdo. So yeah, I like hand drawing, and then I'm also a big believer in note cards. Like, you know, I
Oh,
just
I
making
love some
sure
note
that
cards.
making sure Cooper's betrayal, like ideas will pop in my head and I need to be able to find them again. And so I'll
Oh,
just
you
I
do have good
pile.
handwriting. That was like a printed
Yeah,
font grade
that that was
handwriting.
I practiced that. It's embarrassing. I even ripped off what's his name? Pablo. Gosh, I'm blanking on the guy's name, but he was like he was this unsung hero of title design. He did Stop Making Sense and like Beetlejuice, and he died recently and just spent all of his money, and he was living in the guest house of his son's house. And but he was a genius, and I'm sorry that I'm blanking out his name, but
I know who you're talking about. I can't pick. Also, I feel like it's just a good RIP for David Lynch too, who's a big note card. He always championed the you only need 70 note cards and you've got a movie, basically. So
That's true. That's true. And I just I'm so scatterbrained, and I'll forget ideas too. And I love like the discovery of something I forgot about and being because it's just like, oh, this like what's this? Oh my gosh, I completely forgot about this like little scene, and now I can be inspired to go back and put that
I
in.
also
So
love the act of translating that rather than just typing directly onto a computer. It's so fun when you go to a notebook and go, oh, now I'm going to type this up. And then something happens in that process that deepens it, which I think is really cool.
So that's
Yeah, if
what.
you kind of forget about it and then write it and then go back and then look at your writing, and then you can, yeah, go back and forth.
So that's my whole process is I will literally jot stuff down constantly into a notebook that I carry with me everywhere. I have a ginormous purse because the notebook has to come along. But then like every 10 days, I will write it into various files that I have in my computer system. And I'm always like, I have to write down everything, but it's all very cataloged. It's where my right brain comes out. Like it's a ridiculous process. But yeah, different things will come out when I'm cataloging. And sometimes then I'll look back at it and I'll be able to do like a full paragraph by that time. So yeah, I'm always fascinated by the process and where it
Oh
begins.
yeah.
You
Yeah,
just
I
sit
think
down at line one. Those people
it
are psychotic. I can't even.
I mean it also changes like this last the thing I'm this last spec that I just finished a second draft on. I didn't want to do it's a procedural. I've never written a procedural before, and I wanted like the same discoveries that the character did. So I've never done this before. I didn't outline. I just had kind of a general idea where it was going to go, and it just started from page one and just kind of went with her along the way. And then, I mean, it's going to require so much more rewriting than if I'd outlined, but like it went into interesting directions that I don't think I would have gone if I had just been like so like bird's eye view, like first act, second act, third act. I was just kind of in the weeds the whole time.
That's cool. That's really
I
cool.
wish I could do. We just had novelist Ronald Malfi on the last show, and we were talking about process as well. And how I start with the scene that I can envision. I will write a scene, and then I'll keep doing that until I kind of have like a bunch of scenes, and then it's stringing them together. And so it's like a. So yeah, everybody has their own thing. So yeah, okay.
Well, I'm curious about the visual side of it. So you've been writing a lot, and this is a directorial debut in terms of feature. How early on in this did you think there was a chance you could actually be directing this project? Because I think there's such an assured quality to the it feels a, and I don't want people to take this too literally, but almost like a Wes Anderson palette
It's got
to the
style.
movie, which is really cool to see in a genre piece. And so it
Oh, thank
feels
you.
very assured in that sense. So, like for you, how important was that when you from the idea to deliver this yourself, or did that come later in the piece where you got that opportunity?
Well, it never occurred to me that I'd be able to direct it. And I've been in the business long enough, having worked in television and just worked on, like develop pilots and, like just been around the block to know that sometimes when you attach yourself as a director, you're sandbagging the project. You're like, you're kind of assuring yourself a lower budget and studios aren't going to take you seriously. And, producers are going to be a lot more hands-on. And so I didn't want to stand in the way of this movie. I just, as soon as it like producers became interested in it, I was like, great, let's do whatever we possibly can to make this movie. And I think having that kind of Zen attitude of just taking a step back and being like, what, like whatever the universe is, like decides we'll do. And it went in the hands of Zach Cregger, who had Barbarian hadn't come out yet, and he was looking for his like next project to, he had a couple things, the irons in the fire, but he read the script, he loved it, and he was like, oh, kind of got like went down a little bit of a I don't know, it's like maybe like 5 or 6 weeks where he was attached to it to produce and direct it. And I just embraced that 5 6 weeks because we sat down, we polished a script, made it better. I got his insights, and I think throughout that process he was recognizing that like I do come at everything with a filmmaker's kind of perspective. It's POV is very important to me. I don't mean literally like the shot of a POV, but like whose scene is it? Whose moment is this? How are we going to shoot it? How are you going to block it? I was constantly asking him those questions, and I think he realized it might be easier if he just stepped aside and like produced it and then did his own thing because he's a writer director too. So it did feel a little off that he would direct something that someone else wrote. And I wasn't intentionally doing that. Like he it's just the way I'm so protective of my material, and I've seen directors just fuck it up, and it's heartbreaking. So I want to make sure it's in like the best hands. And of course he's fantastic director. But through that process, yeah, he realized that like maybe I would be the proper director of it. And without me knowing, he went to Bold and Light and he went to Vertigo and got their permission to ask. And one day I got a phone call early in the morning, and he said he needed he wasn't going to direct it, he was going to step aside, but he told Bold and Light and Vertigo that he believed in me as a director, and everyone was on board. And I was so shocked by that phone call that I actually said I need to think about it, because it was just like knowing the stress of directing, I was like, oh my God, do I have the ability, can I do this, am I going to be able to like withhold the stress, can I manage a team, can I like answer a billion questions every day. And it took 2 days, and that was too many days to have figured that out. Like I had happened to listen to a podcast without even seeking it out in that, in those like that kind of 2 days of just staring in the mirror being like, can I do this? And I just happened to stumble across a writer director who early in his career wrote a script, and they said, do you want to direct it? And he turned it down out of fear. And he remembers being on set and seeing like, oh, I could have easily done this and always regretted not, not taking them up on that. And I was like, oh, that's everything I needed to hear. And so I just immediately called Zach up and I said, I'm sorry, it took so long. I want to be the director. Thank you for believing me. And now we're here.
Now, does that change you on a DNA level, though, as a person who was writing and looking for the best possible thing? Now, with your new material, do you see it more like, oh, now I have to see this through as director? Has this experience like changed your approach, do you think?
I think it's the only thing that's changed because I got really good writing direction without writing direction. Like the tricks you can do where you don't have it. I learned early on, if you write like close up of a glass and two ice cubes go into it, the director is not going to do it. He's going to feel like a little bit like you're stepping on my toes. Like you're not going to get a close up of a glass with two ice cubes going into it. So instead, I learned to kind of like gently coax that out of it without any stage direction being like clink two ice cubes drop into it, like writing in phrases and thinking of phrases as shots and kind of subconsciously directing it or unconsciously directing it. And so I'm kind of planting those seeds. And so I'm always thinking about everything I write. I have to, I can't, I'll never write something that's like in an action scene happens here and a car chase happens here. I have to know where everyone's standing. I need to know like when they get up, like when they do their movements. I have to have the blocking in my head. And the only thing that's changed now is that I can put camera direction into the script. Like the thing I'm writing, I'm like, oh, it's so liberating because now I can write, when there needs to be a wide shot, I can say wide shot and I can say we move in, we can push in and not have to worry about a producer being like, hey, can you take that stuff out? Because it's probably going to offend the director. So that's probably the only thing that's changed, really.
So where did you guys shoot at?
We shot in upstate New York. In the Hudson Valley area, we did like a little bit of a location scouting, knowing we'd probably be in the New York area, but we extended it to Connecticut and Massachusetts, saw some places, and just found the perfect place, which this rarely happens. You have an idea of the location and like where everything, like the kitchen's here and the front door's here and Sergey's bedroom's over here. And I walked into that place like, oh, I don't have to do any rewriting. Like literally the location of where the kitchen is to where the living room is to where the dining room is to where the Sergey's bedroom is to where the staircase is was exactly how I envisioned it. The outside was totally different, but I'm like, oh, this is fantastic. Like the blocking is all done. It's made my life very easy. But yeah, that was another, it was like finding a, it's equivalent to the moment that we found Sophie to play Iris. It's like this just feels right.
I mean, she's rolling. I mean, between this and
Yeah.
Heretic and so much before that too. In terms of going
Yeah.
back to your like the visual side of things, were there directors or specific films you went back to as you're designing, you know what your look is, but that would helped you reinvigorate, inspire, shape what you're designing?
Like I have a theory that that shopping cart scene was direct, like Valley of the Doll or
Russ
Stepford
Meyer
Wives,
or oh, Stepford.
because there's the shopping cart push in Stepford
Okay.
Wives. So I had to see if that was correct.
It's not correct, but it's probably subconsciously planted in my head. I made a very conscious choice. I have writer friends that like when they're writing an action movie, they saturate themselves with action movies and they're just, like I'm the exact opposite. I watch everything that's totally different from it because I'm so worried about like subconsciously stealing an idea from one of these movies. So like as soon as I had the concept, I didn't watch Ex Machina. I didn't like even though I'd seen it, I didn't watch Stepford Wives. I didn't want to just accidentally take something and put it in the movie. And so there weren't like visually there wasn't like a lot of like comps like because the tone switched so much, like I didn't want to like sit down with a DP and go like it looks like this thing. We did look at fight scenes specifically and how to like choreograph a very realistic fight scene, and I think everyone kind of goes to Haywire, the Steven Soderbergh movie, like the hotel room scene. We watched that. But as far as like the look of the movie goes, and this became a directive to all heads of departments, was like this We need to strip away all the sci-fi. Like, don't think of this movie in at sci-fi at all. This is not a robot. This is a woman going through a toxic relationship. Like, so this is Marriage Story. This isn't Minority Report. I don't want it to look like any other sci-fi movie. I want it to look real, grounded,
And not
and
cold, right? Because that's the thing.
yeah, not
Science
yet.
fiction almost always goes cold. And I think this is like, this does, that's why I think I said Wes Anderson, there's more of his color palette than there is of a science fiction one. And I think that's a real plus because it just feels, I don't know, it feels more like how maybe she sees the world or something. And she isn't a cold character. She is actually a very warm, she's more human than they are in some ways, which is
I mean,
funny.
that became like, that's, I mean, when I was first coming up with the idea, and before I had actually written a like a single page, and I was just kind of in outlining mode, I originally thought that she would be the antagonist. Like, that was the first thing. It was like, oh, of course, it's a robot goes wrong, and now I've spoiled it. Sorry, I don't, have we
No,
spoiled it
we're
yet?
allowed to say because it's the
And
trailer. In the
that's
trailer.
in the trailer too.
Trailer.
Yeah,
It's
that's
in
in
the
the trailer.
trailer. We can say it.
Sorry, she's a robot. She's a robot. It's in the posters. But it like yeah, so my first instinct was just, oh, a robot gone rogue and it's gonna kill all of his friends, and it's from Josh's perspective. And as soon as like she showed up, as soon as in my head I'm like getting to like, okay, you know, they're in the grocery store scene, there'll be a meet cute, and it's gonna feel off, and like it should feel really hacky. You should feel like you're watching like the most like by the numbers romantic meet cute on the planet, and then the reveal would be like, oh, this is something else. They're going to drive up, they're going to walk into they're going to walk into this environment. And as soon as I'm like, okay, so she's outside the house and she's feeling alienated and lonely and she's nervous. And as soon as I tapped into those emotions, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Like, this is the lead. This is the protagonist. Like, I'm relating to her so much more than all the other characters. And so then that became like, well, could I do this? Can I tell the story of a robot that is the most human character of all everyone, and the most empathetic and the most sympathetic, and that became like the like, I didn't know if I was going to be able to pull it off. And that's a testament to, I think, Sophie and her charisma and her abilities as an actor. So yeah.
I wanted to ask about your blood scenes because without giving spoilers, it does definitely get bloody. So I was so, and this was again like stuff that I would notice, but like how it worked so well with the color palette because there was not a lot of red. And then suddenly when the blood hit, it hit with such authority. So I wanted to find out kind of what you were looking at as you were kind of planning out those blood scenes and what considerations you took in effect.
Well, one thing I'm realizing is I'm so desensitized to violence. I don't think it's that, like, I didn't, it never even occurred to me that was a lot of blood. I mean, like, I know that now, but like when we were shooting it, I was just like, yeah, this is just it's nothing. It's wallpaper. But, and then here, like seeing people cringe, I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. I need to remember, like, not everyone is just like steeped in like horror movie, like gore. And so it became like a, like, well, what's too much? And the answer was, as far as blood goes, like, you know, it's cool to have a ton of blood in a relationship drama. So I wanted to do a realistic amount without feeling cartoony. And yeah, you want to be there, like, with her as she's getting drenched in blood, and yeah. And you want the shock of like when she first shows up in the cabin post, you know, post the first death. You want to, that first shot of her to just be like, come out of nowhere. It's like, oh, it's now in a different territory, because up there's no been no hint. There's been a hint of weirdness and like something's off, but there's no been no hint of violence up until that point. Same with like the first time you see like Josh make his orgasm face. It's like, oh, that's the first time to read, like, oh, this might be a comedy too. You have to, for when you're going to do all these tonal shifts later in the movie, you need to do like little like teases of them throughout the first act. Otherwise they kind of come out of nowhere, and that's another, you know, problem with the movie is when you have tonal shifts, sometimes it can feel like whiplash.
But when it's done right, Barbarian and what in your film, it's they become like layered twists. So there's obviously a great Barbarian has, this great first twist that we pretty
Oh
much
my
see in the
God, one
trailer.
of the
But
best.
underneath that, there is still, and we are going to talk about single location horror films, but it's like in some ways they're not single location because they then take you to another layer of the same place. So it's almost like a totally, just like the idea is getting another twist. And I think you can do that with tone, which I think the film does really well. And I think, there is, that's the nice thing. I saw it like very blind. And so they were all twists, but there was things in your story that I felt was nice because even after this, your first reveal that everyone will now know, there are still surprises to come. And I think that just really helps in this kind of filmmaking. You get invested.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And yeah, and I emphasize to people that the robot reveal isn't like the whole movie. I don't want anyone to watch the trailer being like, yeah, like that's it. I don't need to see it now. There are many more swerves and zigs and zags.
Well, in reality, in the first 2 or 3 minutes, there's so many hints. So I was going in blind where I probably suspected something before I watch it. But even then, within the first couple of minutes, like, oh, something is off about behaviorally and the way they communicated. And then I get, oh, within like 5 minutes, I'm like, oh, okay, I get what this is. And I'm like, oh, that's surprisingly early. But then when I realize, oh, that's because it's not all there is. And so that's your hook, basically. Not necessarily.
Yeah, that was
So,
fun. That was fun at the very beginning when we did the test screenings to see, because those are pure, that's like the purest audience. They don't know any, there's not been a poster, there's not been anything. And just to see, we'll see when we went too far. And the truth is, we went so far with one version that people still gasp when they reveal of her robot. There was a scene where he's walking to the down to the lake, and you see Josh with the phone where he hits a button and then she like twitches. I was like, oh, well, for sure everyone's gonna know she's a robot. That's just like the guy hits a button and woman shits. Of course. And even with that in the movie, we ultimately took that out because we thought that was too much. But even with that in the movie, it didn't like diminish the reveal.
I
Crazy.
do think some
Like,
of that
yeah.
is the casting. I think the casting of someone like Sophie is so good because people almost don't want to believe that she would be the android. They want to believe she's their person, and so I think that really works well for it.
And I think at the beginning too, when you hear the words like the day I killed him, suddenly you're watching his behavior under a microscope. You're like, what's he gonna do that's gonna warrant being killed? And so that was like, a nice lesson in sleight of hand and how you can mislead by presenting an idea that, is totally just a magician being like, hey, look over here.
Shout out to Sunset Boulevard. Storytelling up front. Dead man.
No, and even in some of the secondary roles, I was with a group of people seeing this and they cheered when Harvey came on screen. And all of a sudden it was like, it's Guillermo. Like, it is just such like a fan cult, like just phenomenon
Well, he's
surrounding
the
him.
best. Like, talk about a guy that's just naturally charismatic, where you're just like, oh, you're there, you're there, you're with it. You're like, I love this guy.
There was another horror comedy that he, oh, he was in Josh Rubin's film,
Yeah,
I
Werewolves
believe,
Within.
Werewolves Within, and I loved him in that too. He was still like one of the funniest
He
parts. Like,
steals the show,
it's
steals it,
just
yeah.
so good in horror comedy. So yeah, cast well across the board. Had you always planned for it to basically be a single location horror film, or did you get kind of far along in the writing process and then suddenly go like, wait, I can kind of keep this all contained within this house?
No, I mean, it was calculated. It was, well, I want to get this made. I made the biggest mistake that a writer could make in like my early 30s. Like, I wrote a spec script that was like a $200 million like sci-fi, action adventure. And I was like, why won't anyone want to make this? And it's like, no, I can't make that. I can't fall in that trap again. I need to make something that's producible. And so it was calculated. Like, I need this movie to get made. And so let's just not, just like like me not attaching myself to as a director right away. It was like, let's make this cheap. It'll be sci-fi with big ideas, but like, we are going to be very careful in how we use money. And I write with also a producer hat on, being like, okay, let's limit locations. I know how much that costs. I've show ran a TV show, so I know where, money is wasted. And so Yeah, let's find a location, and it'll be our home base, and it's also it's just great. One of the benefits of having a single location is your cast gets very comfortable there. It's not you're not moving around and like having to find the like it'll become comfortable in that place. Like you're there for weeks and weeks and weeks, and you know every the ins and outs, and so it feels lived in.
So this is single look. So like for people listening, we're talking single location in the generous way. I think there's like hardcore single location as in like cube, like you're just going to be
Yeah,
in a
that's fu so
space, you
funny that
know?
you brought that up. If you could tell me other ones that you'd thought, I mean, I don't know if you want to skip ahead,
Well, no, it's
but I
just,
was like,
yeah, there's those hardcore ones, right? And then there's, but then
Yeah,
there's.
which is what I'm writing now, which I'm like, it's fun. It's really cool. I love the
No.
limitations of being like, can you do
But then
this?
there, but you
Yeah,
guys
like you
have the
have to stay
woods, and
there.
like Evil Dead, which is a classic, is yes, it's a cabin, but it is also the woods. A lot of stuff happens in the woods. So, but they are connected, and your film, a lot of it takes place in the woods, and but it's still connected around a central
And the
space.
supermarket and Josh's apartment. We leave it, the same way the barbarian leaves it occasionally, and like the shine, like the Shining, starts out
I
and
wonder though
before they
if I
get
always
there.
view it as like 90% is the way that I always classify
Or
it. If
when the
it's
horror starts,
90,
right?
when or the bulk of the story, because like I always view it as like Get Out for me is a single location horror film. We may start in his apartment for all of like a minute and 30 seconds, and then we have like 40 seconds of driving sequence, but the rest of the movie, we are at that vacation house and we do not leave. So for me, that is a single location horror film, but it's a different type because you do have all these different rooms and all these different places on the property that they're going to. So it feels like you're switching scenes. It still feels big. The ones that I'm always inspired by are like the cubes where, Circle does it, or I'll even say like I really like The Devil, or what is it called? The one in the elevator. Yeah, Devil.
Oh yeah, a devil,
Where it is like an hour in an elevator, and how do you make that captivating? Those are the ones that I'm always like super inspired by. The
Yeah,
ones
or
that, you know.
Buried. I don't know if you count Buried as a horror movie, but it's definitely a thriller. I mean,
When he's
they never leave. They never leave that coffin.
I'll tell you the
Those.
masterclass, like the movie that I hadn't seen in like a 15 years, and then suddenly pulled it out to show a class, and then I was just like, this is the one of the best made movies ever made. Misery. Watch that movie
Oh yeah,
again.
that's on my
When
list.
we talk about
Single location.
blocking, it's like I watch that thing and I'm like, oh my God, every single beat of this movie, you just feel the brilliance of where they've blocked characters and how they've moved, and by limiting those movements of one of the characters for so long. And it's that's a perfect single location example, because the horror is all taking
Agreed.
place once you're there. And Aliens, obviously, the first Alien, again, it has the cheats, it has the layers, right? We're mostly on the ship, but we're also there's layers within the ship and different looks.
And Misery also has the idea that he's hobbled, and so that tiny location just becomes gigantic,
For
and
him.
that's just adds another layer to it.
And I always like the ones where they take the one location and make it feel intentionally claustrophobic, like 10 Cloverfield Lane. I
I love
always
that
consider
movie.
to be just so brilliantly made because we are looking at what I suspect is supposed to be like a 500 square foot bunker, but how they're shooting it to make it feel like the characters have alone time and like they have their own space, but it still feels like they're constantly on top of each other.
And that movie loses me actually when they leave the bunker. Like I the bunkers like I almost I think they did themselves a disservice. I almost wonder, could you start the movie with her waking up in the bunker? Like, do you need to see her leaving or like leaving a ring on like the bookcase, and like could that movie work if it was a pure single location? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe it wouldn't, but like I would have loved to seen that exercise.
I have argued this so many times because I had students that absolutely love that ending and are like, man, I would have loved more of that ending. But I'm the opposite, where I'm like, I could have stayed in that bunker forever because that was where the tension was. As soon as we left, the tension, even though that now she's like giant fucking aliens blowing up the house and the truck that she's in, it did not hold the same level of suspense for me and fear for me as being in the bunker with like Crazy John Goodman did. So yeah, like it lost the fear, even though that we blew up the world.
Agreed. And when you set up your character's need as being escaping the bunker, as soon as she escapes the bunker, she's met her need, and then it just feels like kind of like too much frosting on this cake.
And I felt like so much of what they built up was, is there actually something happening outside, or is he just keeping them there for like shits and giggles? And then as soon as we go outside and answer that question, it was very much like we're done here. But yeah, now we get to
Yeah, I
see it
mean, we
again.
have. What I mean, what if she like? What if it's like a big, like, you make the big final fight scene between John Goodman just as epic as you can in that space, and it's not just the fire; it's like fighting back and forth, and then she leaves, and the camera stays in the window, and you just maybe just get the hint of an alien ship going by or something, just to be like, oh, that like if you need that kind of like that little like answer for the question, maybe you don't. I don't know.
You know, there was a really it was super bleak film from back like 2000 teens that I want to say was Canadian. I can't even remember where it came out of, called The Divide. And it was that. It was a bunch of people in a bunker in like a fallout
And
shelter
Michael Biehn was one of them,
after
yeah.
Michael Biehn, and I can't remember who the lead actress was, but she was somebody at the time that Lauren German.
Think it was Javier Gens directed that, I think.
You're
I'm
right. You're
trying
right. It's
to.
got Rosanna Arquette's in it as well, but it is that. It's a group of people in a fallout shelter as we think nuclear war is happening outside. We don't really know, except that they start suffering the effects of radiation poisoning, so you don't know the scope. But yeah, and it was real small, and it was entirely focused on kind of like them starting to go crazy on each other. And it worked. It was super bleak, but that said,
Gotta add that to my list. Yeah, that's awesome.
It's definitely bleak. It's very bleak. It's kind of part of the French. It feels almost French extreme. It was like the thing. I mean, the cool thing, I don't remember who the quote, but deeper, not broader, really applies to these kind of movies. I think, like, going back to Night of the Living Dead, it's like, okay, you have to go deeper with the characters. You have to go deeper with the structure. Like, in that case, Night of the Living Dead does a great job of making it like political, the interior of the house. Like, the line where the guy says, like, you want to be, I'm boss up here, you can be boss downstairs. It's creating a structure within a single location. And I think that's a really, really smart filming. I think in the last couple of years, somebody who, I mean, King adaptations in general, there's a lot of them that touch in this way, like from The Mist, but like Flanagan's Hush and Gerald's Game both use this so well. I think both of them are really satisfying in how they treat the single location.
I think Oculus is one
Oh
too.
yeah, you're right.
I think
It
he's
is.
several.
Yeah. And that one was completely designed out of the short film, which was a single location and designed that way so they could shoot it themselves, but then kind of became this like, there was a stretch I remember, right, it was probably around the 2000 teens, where that was like the golden goose was, how do you have one location, just a couple of actors? And it was very much like the Your Next model of, how do we do something amazing in a single location with like under 10 actors, but yet sell it to a studio and blow up the world with it? So
Yeah,
I remember that.
paranormal activity,
Yep, I remember that. Yeah, and it was just like everybody was trying to find like what that is and how you do it well. And yeah, it's something that definitely takes some effort.
But some of those are for
Yeah,
budgetary
it's
reasons, like that when you say paranormal, but then I think of The Descent, it's like that's not saving you any money by being, you're saying you have to create a whole nother
Or like,
world.
or like Signs where they actually fully built a farmhouse.
But something like House of the Devil, I see that as a cost-saving method, but it did it so cleverly that it was like, okay, that movie made me forget that I was just in one house the entire time and, kind of transported me elsewhere.
It's great. It's a great exercise for writers because it forces you to really like really explore character because it's how these characters are dealing with the location because the scope is so limited. So it's going to be about the interactions and the primary obstacles, the primary confrontations are going to be human to human, which you need to like that is like the purest form of writing. So like if you're struggling and you feel like you don't understand character, emotional journeys, character arcs, put a couple actors in one setting. I think Paul Thomas Anderson said, it's like, whenever he can't think of an idea, he just puts two characters that are like opposite of each other at like talking at a diner and just goes from there.
And then he drinks their milkshake like he does. No, I mean it's great. It's like you have to earn it. It's like let's see if I can earn breaking out of this location. And
Now, another one that I was having a conversation with somebody a couple of days ago about is Red Eye, because that one I view as, and even the one that I covered on our other show, Deep Cuts Phone Booth, a couple of weeks ago, the idea of now my character is basically glued in one place. It goes back to that elevator thing that I love, the idea of like, I have two characters on an airplane stuck in airplane seats. How do I build out the tension? Or I have a character who is literally stuck in a phone booth. How do I create the tension if they can't, get up, move around, go blow things up and everything? Like, I
We'll
think
talk
it.
about another movie that does the 10 Cloverfield Lane is Red Eye. It just sucks as soon as they leave the plane. It's just
Yep.
like
Big
it's too
time.
big. It's hotel
Same.
rooms and missile launchers. It's just stupid. It's just like no, commit to it. I think it comes from insecurity, or maybe it's a studio note being like,
I
well,
feel
you
like,
know, like it
yes.
needs to get bigger in the third act. Third acts are big. Yeah, like it's unfortunate.
Even Trap from last year, Elric, I
What's
saw that
Trap?
one with you.
Wait,
Yeah.
remind me of my.
Trap was,
Sorry, M.
it
Night.
was at the
Sharknado.
concert. We saw that one together, and it was the same where I loved the stuff at the concert. I thought it was amazing, but as
Big
soon as they
mistake.
left the concert, I was like, why? I feel like the movie's over now. Like we've reached our goal was to escape the doors of the concert.
There's a
So
reason why that's the trailer. The trailer is just that.
I enjoyed that movie because it was just like there are no rules here. Like the char I don't know any decision that this character is making, and like you know he's getting out of situations where he just happens to reach into his pocket and finds the right like ID card in the moment. It's just like every decision he's building like a fake version of himself using like tactical gear and like concert swag.
I'm a
Even though there's a
security
windshield,
guard.
there's a windshield right there. Isn't everyone seeing him make like construct this thing, right? Like I thoroughly enjoy that movie, but from a point of like, this is fucking crazy. This is a crazy movie.
M. Night's so good with like, you know, adding his extra twists that when I went to watch that movie, I had already created another twist in my head. So I'm watching the movie going, no, Josh Hartnett's not the killer. He's got the killer tied up at home and he's going to kill him and doesn't want anyone to figure this out because he's getting revenge. And so the movie's so much better in my head as I'm watching it.
Oh God,
But then he
that's
gets
an
home,
awesome
and by the
twist.
end, I was like, oh, it's just this. I was giving M. Night so much credit. I was coming up with an extra twist for him because.
Yeah, and
But I
that's the
will.
problem with twist movies is you're rewriting the movie, or you're writing the movie yourself after you see the trailer. Like, don't worry, darling. That's a reason why I don't mind the reveal being in the trailer for Companion, because then it becomes a twist movie, and people watch twist movies different than they watch regular movies. They're not enjoying it. They're not sitting back. They're just going like, I got to figure out what's here. I got to figure out the like what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, that was one
And
of the
those
great trailers
movies,
that for that film, and it didn't deliver at all.
But I do have to give M. Night credit that he does kind of nail the idea of really making something innovative in single spaces. Because if we think like old, he did that, The Visit. And I mean, whether or not I completely love the ending of some of these, I still am always like, this hook in this location, I'm totally in. Like, I don't even care how old ended. I was so in that for like
I
90
loved
minutes.
old,
I was like, I don't even care how
but
this is ending. It's great.
I mean that qualifies as a single location all on a beach. Like
Just the
that
beach.
sequence, one of the best sequences I saw that year was when the kids are running from the woman as she's like breaking arms and becoming a monster. That was one of the most, that was my favorite sequence of like any movie. I thought it was haunting. It reminded me like, oh, he's a master. He still has it. He's a master filmmaker. I wish Trap had those moments, but I still, you know, it's its own thing.
I was still in for most of it. Stuff and popcorn in my face going, I don't know how he's going to get out of this. And then he gets out of that. So,
One
I
last
just
one.
read that book, the Man Who Heard Voices. I literally, that's the last book I read. It's fascinating, like way into his brain.
Oh, wait, so that's an M. Night book?
It's about the making of Lady in the Water. It's like
Oh.
he had a journalism a journalism he had a journalism he had a journalist follow him while he was making it.
Ah,
And
interesting.
it's about him leaving Disney for the first time and going with Warner Brothers. And it ends right before the movie comes out. So it's not like in hindsight, like this was like, you know, a thing that kind of had to, you know, it destroyed his career and he had to kind of reinvent himself. But it's fascinating to see him kind of not listening to people that were maybe giving him good advice and
My favorite creepy one, like that actually, because that's hard to scare us obviously at this point, but the one that really got under my skin the first time we saw it was Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Yeah, I think that's on my list.
Excellent use of space.
That surprised me. That surprised me because I just could kind of dismissed it, and someone said, "No, you should watch it." I watch it by myself, and I don't get scared very often anymore. And that one for sure
It's
scared me.
unsettling. Yeah, it's a very creepy and uses the space so well to, with the fear. We should also give a quick shout out to a mutual friend of the show and yours, JD Lifshitz, who we talked about off air for helping get this film Boulder Light, get it to the screen.
Well,
and
Yeah,
they've
I mean,
done, I mean, even just like The Vigil, I would definitely say is one
yeah, very, very
location.
much.
I mean, they've done a couple of these. Becky, is Becky one location?
Yeah, it ends up being.
Kind of,
Yeah, it is. Yeah. There's a lot of wood stuff, but yeah, it's one location.
basically one cabin. So JD's good at
JD's
these.
great. JD's great. And that's crazy how he got involved, because I had just because we said off broadcast that he was a friend of a friend. And so that friend sent me the script for Barbarian as I was writing Companion, not knowing that the whole team behind Barbarian would be making the movie. So I'm reading Barbarian and it's inspiring me. Like that twist that happens halfway through. I'm like, yes, you could do whatever you want. Like it's just as long as it's exciting to you. And so even though I don't do like a full like POV switch like that, it did remind me that like, oh, you had like, part of the secret to writing, something good is just entertaining yourself a lot of the time. And it'll probably just have faith that it'll also entertain other people. So that was great that like it came full circle that they became involved
You
with
know,
my movie.
that's great.
every so years ago, Elric owned this tiny little cafe. I didn't mean to call it tiny. It was a mighty cafe. It was adorable. It was like a little micro cinema in Studio City called Jump Cut that we all used to host screenings at. And I remember Larry Cohen did a script read
Oh, that's
there
right, yeah.
of this film. It was set in a movie theater. I can't even remember kind of the
Yeah, I've
twist
got
of
the
it.
script somewhere here. Yeah, I've got it.
It was,
Maybe a
I
shooter or
remember,
something in a movie theater. I can't recall exactly what's happening.
I remember it reminded me of Angst. Is that it? Where like what you're watching in the theater is happening in the
Anguish,
theater
anguish.
itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Anguish. So it had kind of a meta quality to it. But I remember afterwards, I specifically asked him about how it seemed like it had multiple endings and then it would kind of reinvent itself and keep going. And that was something that he said in that talk back was that he is a writer. Would intentionally paint himself into a corner. And he would do it all the time because he felt like that's how you make it like a jaw drop scene. So he would intentionally paint himself into a corner with the script. And just when he would think like, I don't know how I'm ever going to get out of this. I can't get out of this. The characters can't get out of this. He would go to sleep and the next day he would get up and instead of thinking of it as like, this is where my characters have ended, he would think like, this is where they've begun and think about that as the beginning of the script and then keep going for another 30 pages. And so that's how I always think about twists now, is it's like you have to kind of push yourself into that corner and then come at it with new eyes. So words from Larry Cohen, who is just immortal writer and
That's
should be
great
shouted.
advice. Yeah. And for anyone listening to that advice, just remember when you do that, it's easier said than done. When you paint yourself in a corner, it is going to feel
I
terrifying
can't.
and scary, and you will not know the answer and you won't think it'll come to you. And yeah, that is a very real fear. Like, oh, I'm a hack. I don't know how to get
That's,
out of here.
I'm always like, I'm so wasting my time because I'm never going to get out of this and it's going to be
Yeah.
terrible. And I might as well just write where I know where the path leads because at least I can
Yeah.
see the light at the end. I get so
Yeah.
scared in writing exercises like that. Like, you know, what am I even
Yeah.
doing? So,
But
yeah.
yeah, but I love that it also incorporates this like what I call, it can happen at night, but like when you're sleeping, but I call them the shower moments, which is just when you're not thinking about the idea, that the idea will just pop in your head. And weird things like things in Companion that I can't say because it spoils things that aren't spoiled in the trailer, but things would pop in my head on a hike, but just because I would saturate myself in the story and the characters, and you have to just fill your head with that and that alone, and then trust that it'll work itself out. And in weird moments where you're not, sometimes you need to put the computer away or put the pencil down and just go on a drive or a hike or exercise. And in the strangest, it's a miracle how the brain works and figures itself out when you're not trying to figure something out.
So the alien twist at the end of your film came in the shower. Okay, good. We should end there just so
when
people get to the when you get to the alien guys.
When they get to the aliens, that's the shower moment. So, Drew, tell us where we can see this.
You could see it in theaters January 31st in IMAX, which is crazy. It's playing at the Vista in 35 millimeter. I'm just feel so blessed that, it's giving a wide release, but it's also, you know, they made a print of it. And yeah, I'd see it in any way you can. Hopefully in the theater. I think this day and age, it's easy to, you know, stay at home and watch Twisters or Beetlejuice or something, some other like legacy sequel that exists now. Like, support an original idea and please go see the movie.
It has a lot of humor too, which I think horror like this with humor plays best with the crowd. So
yeah,
I think people enjoy it. Yeah, the Vista is a great place to go. We you know, seeing Maxine and certain films on film there, it's a real buzz to get to see the way you want them to be screened on such a great theater. So
I won't be seeing it. I'm so sick of the movie.
Oh,
but
we understand. Yeah. We get that. But congrats, because it really is. It's a really great
Thank
film.
You.
And January's notorious sometimes for not good films, and this is a great one. So it's a great launch into the year right at the end of January. So. Well done.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Drew. And thank you everybody for listening. If you enjoyed this and you're looking for the really weird stuff where we stash all the really weird titles, you can check us out over on our Patreon show, Deep Cuts. And we will be back in another 2 weeks with another fun show and a bunch more brand new films. The Colors of the Dark podcast is a Fangoria production. Producers and co-hosts are Rebecca McKendry and Elric Kane. Executive producers are Tara Ainsley and Abby Gould. Sonic branding by Michael Rodriguez. And, of course, our amazing sound engineer, Ernie Hurtado.